And thank you all for coming out to hear this inaugural lecture. I'm in equal parts happy and terrified to stand in front of you. I do apologize in advance for the fact my voice is quite hoarse, and it's likely to become more so. So we'll get huskier and huskier as we go, and pretty soon I'll be singing songs, Edith Piaf or somebody. Thank you in particular to the master and fellows of Pembroke and all the people who have made me feel so welcome here. And thank you as well to the Annual Fund, and in particular to the J.R.R. Tolkien Trust for creating this opportunity for me and in the future for other writers, I hope, to speak about fantasy literature in a place that can feel like its homeland. I'm in the happy position of giving the inaugural lecture, which means I have no precedence, no one I will be compared to unfavorably at this point. It is nevertheless intimidating to speak before an audience that includes some of the foremost scholars in the field of speculative fiction. I have read your works and learned from them. How much or how little may become evident in the course of this talk. An inaugural lecture also gives some leeway for content, and as this is a lecture in honor of Tolkien and not necessarily about him, I'm reaping the benefit of that. I am not a scholar nor a critic. What I am is a writer, and such insights as I have about the field are rooted in that, a craftswoman's desire to understand the conventions, the origins, and the potential of her chosen form. Tonight, I'm going to talk a bit about some tools that I find useful as I consider my medium, and then explore how they became useful in my writing. This year, I accepted a post as an assistant professor at the University of Kansas, which is home to the Center for the Study of Science Fiction, and also to science fiction scholar and Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America Grandmaster James Gunn, who became my mentor many years ago. I was hired primarily to teach writing, but there are occasional literature classes as well. And this fall, I gave my first literature class, An Introduction to Fantasy, which was primarily about foundational works in the fantastic mode, not necessarily going into works of the 70s, 80s, and more recent years. To frame the class, I drew heavily from Brian Atterbury's critical work, Strategies of Fantasy, which came out in 1992. It was by no means the newest work in the field, but it was very accessible, and its opening chapters helped us as a class define for ourselves what fantasy was and what it was not. One tool he gave us was the very useful distinction between fantasy as a mode of narrative, as a genre, and as a formula. Atterbury describes the fantasy mode as a narrative approach, broad enough to include myths, literary ghost stories, surrealism, anything that is not real. In contrast, the fantasy formula is a toolbox of elements, characters, conventions, and even modes of narration that are used by writers and publishers to create works that satisfy the reader's demand for something that they've already read before, unfortunately. So often the fantasy toolbox becomes a toolbox that people can create. It becomes a kit, and people just reassemble the pieces. When he talked about formula, Atterbury was especially thinking about heroic and epic fantasy, which were very common and very popular at that period. But in recent years, another formula that has become perhaps almost as important is the urban fantasy formula, Jim Butcher's Dresden Files and its many and many ilk. His definition of the fantasy genre then, its mode, formula, genre, his definition of the genre was a synthesis of these two. Fiction in the fantastic mode given shape by formulaic restrictions of content, voice, and the like. My class mostly, as I said, spent its time thinking about fantasy in its broadest sense, the fantastic mode. Most critics of speculative fiction will agree with the statement that science fiction, like mainstream fiction, is fiction about things that could happen, and that fantasy is about things that could not happen. With science fiction, you can potentially see a way to get from here, this world, here and now, to there, the world that your story is in. There is no break with reality. There's only a distance that has to be crossed between here and there. That distance may be technology, it may be time, it may be scientific understanding, or something else. According to this distinction, fantasy does require a break with reality, you really can't get there from here. And I'm sorry to tell you, there is not necessarily a way to get through the back of a wardrobe, and there are not vampires. Sorry. Brian Atterbury says that fantasy requires some violation of what the author clearly believes to be natural law. And Catherine Hume refers to a departure from consensus reality, which I like even better. Reality is not what is certainly possible in this sense, it is what is believed to be possible. Many things are not real, but according to the consensus of reality, the consensus reality of their time, they could have been real. There is no great distance between headless men with faces on their stomachs and elephants, particularly for people who have seen neither. Atterbury also discussed Northrop Frye, who in his 1957 book, Anatomy of Criticism, argued that there's a fundamental division within literature, two opposing modes. One is the mimetic mode, the impulse to exactly reproduce things as they are seen to be. The other is the mythic mode, which Atterbury revised somewhat and called the fantastic mode, which opened the door to things that did not and could not exist. My students and I worked with these two opposing impulses. We worked with these two opposing impulses, and we used them as two poles for anchoring a continuum, the mimesis fantasy continuum. We tried to set every single story we studied somewhere on that line in comparison to every other story. And this, especially as the semester went on, became more and more complex, and we found that sometimes stories worked on both, very much on both ends of the continuum simultaneously, which we found really interesting. The mimetic pole, in contrast to the, at least as defined by my class, was defined as personal experience, what I have felt, what I have done, but not writing about personal experience, because no matter how realistic or autobiographical a work of literature is, it's still not quite all the way to the experience. Mimetic literature is work that's imitative of reality, of course, repertorial. It's also often naturalistic. It is not necessarily quotidian, but it is usually engaged with immediate details and description. It is Tobias Wolff, or Raymond Carver, or Tim O'Brien. You know, I would whisper in my heart, although not to my students, the boring stuff, although in fact I like Tim O'Brien quite a lot. The mythic or fantastic pole, in contrast, is the place where anything is possible. It is an inchoate mass of ideas and images. It has no limit. It is dream space. It is God space. Again, words enforce order. So we agreed that art was closer to the pole of the mythic pole than literature. And the obvious points, surrealist authors, artists René Magritte and Leonora Carrington, were easy enough, but we decided actually that abstract art, one individual's completely unmediated vision, was closer to the truly mythic pole. Again, words enforce order. So we decided at last that creation myths were probably our most extreme literary example, because God logic is in play and there are no limits at all to what is possible. There is no entirely mimetic or fantastic literature because both extremes of the continuum are inaccessible, essentially, to the reader. The mimetic pole has no room for anything but the writer's unmediated reproduction of an experience she has had. The fantastic pole is an unshaped mass of the writer's unfiltered dream stuff. Neither compromises with the reader and her own experiences, her own mythic impulses. So there's always a balance between mimetic and realistic, or mimetic and fantastic in a story. In realistic fiction, the fantastic may be no more than the extrapolation that's required for the writer to present something she has not experienced. I am not a man who is in the Manhattan Project, but perhaps I can write about him. That would be a fantastic element to a story that I might write. In high fantasy, the mythic impulse is very obvious, although it is usually anchored by conventional narrative tools and by descriptive telling details. And this is this stuff we love so much in Tolkien, when we get the details of place and the details of landscape. The Iliad and Beowulf, which are two works unequivocally in the fantasy mode, both demonstrate, quite apart from their high mythic impulses, a real very vivid, exquisite attention to detail, some of it very grisly. In modern day fantasies, such as urban fantasy, the fantastic impulse is clearly present, but the mimetic impulse towards real or imagined but possible experience is stronger than in heroic works. So stories are set not in Middle Earth, but in Seattle or Minneapolis. And their protagonists wear clothes that probably I have in my closet, and they probably use the internet. A third balance appears in some magical realism and slipstream fantasy. The mimetic impulse can appear to dominate a slipstream story so that it seems real, but at the heart there is a single impossibility that puts everything, that sets everything into a sort of strangeness. It causes us to view everything slightly differently. And this is where I live as a writer. In much of my fiction, the world is as close to our own as I can make it. There's Subarus, there are state fairs, but there is one single impossible element, a river made entirely of bees, for instance, or a bathtub that teleports monkeys, but only monkeys. Except the single break with reality and the rest, character, plot, voice, and so forth, is then naturalistic. But the irrational break must nevertheless be there, or I cannot write the story. It is the reason for the story for me. By halfway through this semester, we were cutting and pasting our theories to suit ourselves, and we decided that there was a third element that affected whether we perceived something as fantasy or not. A story did feel mimetic or fantastic because of its material. Elves felt like fantasy, and divorces felt like reality. But also important was how the narrative engaged with itself. Was it telling its story without reminding you that it was a story, or was it pointing to itself, calling the reader's attention to the fact that it wasn't reality? In other words, was it naive, or was it self-aware and metafictional? A naive tale does not necessarily observe itself. It is the majority of popular fiction, and this is independent of voice, style, and content. I, as the writer of a naive tale, set out to tell the reader a story, and I do it in such a way that she may, if she chooses, fall into it and be rewarded by experiencing it from the inside, as it were. In contrast to the naive tale is the self-aware story, which engages directly with itself and with the nature of narrative. It forcibly reminds the reader that she is not in that place with those people. She cannot immerse herself, and so she must find other rewards in the story for reading it. By calling attention to itself, the story also calls attention to the nature of narrative in general, and because all fantasy, by definition, breaks with reality, all fantasy also calls attention to the fact that it is a story. All fantasy can be seen as metafiction. This was, for us, a worthwhile third axis. How self-aware is the story? How much does it engage with the nature of story? A story can be about an entirely realistic event, such as a messy divorce, and still feel like a fantasy if the writer is engaging with the story as if it were one. So, as a writer, I spend a lot of time trying to find the place where these three impulses balance to my satisfaction. And one of my more recent stories was an attempt to balance on the exact point, a story that points to itself in the most obvious way. It is, in fact, called Story Kit, and that is exactly what it is. It's a kit for telling a story. It is the collection of materials that a writer is using to create something that we, the readers, never actually get to read, but which balances her personal, very realistic experiences against a mythic tale. This is how it starts. Six story types from Damon Knight. One, the story of resolution. The protagonist has a problem and solves it or doesn't. Two, the story of explanation. Three, the trick ending. Four, a decision is made. Whether it is acted upon is irrelevant. Five, the protagonist solves a puzzle. Six, the story of revelation. Something hidden is revealed to the protagonist or to the reader. It has to start somewhere, and it might as well be here. Medea, Hypsipyle, Ariadne, Tessa the D'Urbervilles, Madame Butterfly, Anna Karenina, Emma Bovary, Ophelia. Dido, the Aeneid. Letter 7 of Ovid's Heroides, lines 143 to 382 of The House of Fame, lines 924 to 1367 of The Legend of Good Women, a play by Marlowe, an opera by Purcell. Wikipedia, Dido, Aeneas. The pain of losing something so precious that you did not think you could live without it, oxygen. The ice breaks beneath your feet, your coat and boots fill with water and pull you down. An airlock blows, vacuum pulls you apart by the eyes, the pores, the lungs. You awaken in a fire, the door and window are outlined in flames. You fall against a railing, the rusted iron slices through your femoral artery. You are dead already. She can write about it if she is careful, if she keeps it far enough away. Dido's a smart woman, and she could have predicted his betrayal, as Aeneas has always been driven before the gusting winds that are the gods. His city, Troy, falls to their squabbling, the golden stones dark with blood dried to sticky dust and clustered with flies, collateral damage, like a dog accidentally kicked to death in a brawl. Aeneas huddles his few followers onto ships and flees, but Juno harries him and sends at last a storm to rip apart his fleet. He crash lands in a bay near Carthage. His mother, Venus, another fucking god, guides him to shelter. Dido is Renard. She is Coyote. No gods have driven her, or if they have, she has beaten them at their own game. She also was forced from her land, but she avenged her father first, then stole her brother's ships and left with much wealth and a loyal, hard-eyed army. Rather than fight for a foothold on the Libyan shore, she uses trickery to gain land from the neighboring kings. They cannot reclaim it except through marriage, so she plays the faithful widow card, and now they cannot force her into marriage either. If she continues to play her cards well, the city she founds here will come to rule the seas and the world. The neighboring kings understandably resent how this is working out. She begins to build. When Aeneas arrives on her shores, Carthage is a vast construction site, threaded with paths, its half-finished walls fringed with cranes and scaffolds and hemmed with great white stones waiting to be lifted into place. Aeneas comes to her court, a suppliant, impoverished and momentarily timid. He is a good-looking man. If anything, his scars emphasize that. The aura of his divine failure wraps around him like a cloak. Dido feels the tender contempt of the strong for the unlucky, but this is mixed with something else, a hunger that worms through her bones and leaves them hollow to be filled with fire. There is a storm. They take shelter in a cave where they kiss, where for the first time she feels his weight on her. Words are exchanged. And afterward, when they lie tangled together and their sweat dries to cold salt on her skin, he tells Dido that Jupiter has promised him a new land to replace his lost Troy, Italy. He is somewhat evasive, but in any case, she does not listen carefully, content to press her ear to his breast and hear the rumble of his voice stripped of meaning. There is every reason to believe he will be no stronger against the gods this time, but Dido loves him. The writer kneels on the dark tiles of the kitchen floor and begs anything, anything at all. She will die, she tells him. She will not survive this loss. Her face is slick with snot. There's blood on your face, he says. Her tears are stained red from where she has broken a vein in her eye. Her heart is skipping beats, trying to catch up with this new rhythm that does not include him. She runs to the bathroom, which a year ago they painted the turquoise of the Aegean Sea. He kneels beside her as she vomits, but does not touch her, as though he wishes he could help, but does not know how. She cannot figure out what has happened. It seems he cannot either, but the wind fills his sails. He is already gone. This may or may not be fantasy, depending on the status of Dido's story within StoryKit. Is it the tale that the story kit creates, or is it just background for an otherwise solidly realistic story? Or is it something else? You can't know because of the metafictional nature of the story. I, Kish Johnson, am writing about an unnamed writer who is carefully not writing her own story, but is remembering Dido's tale, which the narrator of the story, who may or may not be either me or the writer, is remembering or maybe is actually telling. So StoryKit, it does, in addition, include a number of abortive story fragments, none of which appear to be the writer's final story. So what is the final story? It is both the story, the metafictional story called StoryKit, and it is something that is never, never seen, which to my mind is exactly the way most fiction works, that the story we see on the page is not ever the vision that the writer has. When my short story collection came out this fall, reviewers pretty consistently mentioned the range of the stories. They knew some of it was realistic, and some was science fiction, and some was fantasy, although they guessed wrong sometimes about which was which. And after that, the word uncategorizable got thrown around a lot. To my mind, there's a great consistency in what I do. My work is always, at its heart, fantasy. My stories don't exist without the thing that is not, the dream moment. Without the story of Dido and Aeneas, I cannot tell the story of the divorced writer, no matter how many details from my personal life I choose to use. StoryKit was an attempt to get as far into metafiction and yet stay as close to the mimetic end of the spectrum as I could. This is another recent attempt at mimesis, a couple of entries from an unpublished story, The Apartment Dweller's Bestiary. This will be put out as a chapbook by Small Beer Press this year, and I'm happy to say it'll be illustrated by the Welsh artist Jackie Morris. The Einkolo. You're showing your boyfriend what to put in a smoothie, and you open a cupboard because he told you that he had toasted coconut somewhere, and you figure, sure, coconut, why not? And that's where his Einkolo is, squatting in the yellow serving bowl his mom gave him last year for Christmas. That's cool. You have lots of friends with Einkolos. They get in everywhere. But he was so weird about it. Picked up the bowl with the Einkolo hunched down now, nothing visible but two eyes and a cloud of cream-colored fur, and took it out to the living room and hid it somewhere. Why? Why? But this got you wondering what else there was. What numbers in his contacts list? What porn on his hard drive? What texts? What friends? What memories? And you realized you really don't know anything about him, and more, that you don't really want to. You have your own secrets, one of them that you aren't over your last boyfriend yet, and that his is still the only name in your favorites list. The Lopi. When you move into the apartment on Vermont Street, the Lopi are already there, two or three of them fluttering in the corners of each room, just where the walls and the ceilings meet. What exactly do they look like? Like bats? Like insects? Like tiny silent birds the color of smoke? They never seem to rest. And what do they eat? Do they chew on your soap, lick the shampoo residue from the bottles in the bathroom? Or late at night, when you are trying but unable to sleep, do they swoop down to eat whatever has fallen into the aluminum liners under the stove's burners? Wikipedia is of limited assistance here. Before you moved in, your landlord promised to replace the old windows and repaint the dirty walls, and also to take care of that Lopi problem. The windows are done, the walls now a tasteful eggshell color, but the Lopi remain. And really, it's not worth calling the landlord about them. They're not that bad. They replace the pictures you don't hang. The whirring of their wings is a white noise that conceals the silence. And there are nights when you are alone in the full-sized bed, in the single bedroom, in the new apartment, everything so much smaller than your old life. And just as you fall asleep, you feel their feet on your face, delicate as antennae or memories. I could write stories about single people alone in apartments without peculiar little animals roving through them, but it would not satisfy me as the beasts do, the Einkolo and the Lopi and the Bajits and the rest. The beasts become symbols for and defenses against isolation in a way no merely realistic element could, for the characters, but also for me, the writer. Could I write unflinchingly about staring up at a ceiling alone without Lopi fluttering in the corners? At the opposite end of the mythic mimetic spectrum for me is my very short story, Mantis Wives, which was published by Clark's World magazine online this year. This is a beginning of that. Eventually, the Mantis women discovered that killing their husbands was not inseparable from the getting of young. Before this, a wife devoured her lover piece by piece during the act of coition, the head and its shining eyes going dim as she ate, the long green prothorax, the forelegs crisp as straws, the bitter wings. She left for last the metathorax and its pumping legs, the abdomen, and finally the phallus. Mantis women needed nutrients for their pregnancies. Their lovers offered this, as well as their seed. It was believed that mantis men would resist their deaths if permitted to choose the manner of their mating, but the women learned to turn elsewhere for nutrients, and yet the men lingered. And so their ladies continued to kill them, but slowly now, in the fashioning of difficult arts. What else could there be between them? The bitter edge. A wife may cut through her husband's exoskeletal plates, each layer a different pattern, so that to look at a man is to see shining hard brocade. At the deepest level are visible pieces of his core, the hint of internal parts bleeding out. He may suggest shapes, the eccentric curve of his thoughts. A wife may drill the tiniest hole into her lover's head and insert a fine hair. She presses carefully, striving for specific results, a seizure, a novel pheromone burst, a dance that ends in self-castration. If she replaces the hair with a wasp's narrow syringing stinger, she may blow air bubbles into his head, and then he will act unpredictably. There is otherwise little that he can do that will surprise her or himself. What is the art of the men that they remain to die at the hands of their wives? And what is the art of the wives that they kill? It would be possible to say some of the same things in a realistic story. Perhaps a modern-day story about a couple, Sue and Jerry, let's say, and some particular ways they are cruel to one another. Sue and Jerry might argue, let's say in a car on a snowy night, the sort of fight that starts with a grocery list and ends in a kind of grinding despair and the realization that for years they have cut and cut and cut at each other and yet cannot find the courage to change things. I could tell that story, but that would be to miss the point of this story. We are all cruel to each other, or we think we are, or we permit or suffer or ask another to be cruel to us. It is inhuman, and yet it is universal. Much of what I have written over the years has been epistemological. What is real? How can I be sure my experience of the world is the same as anyone else's? What is the consensus reality, and who determines it? Since these are the questions I ask, fantasy is the mode in which I ask them. It is a mode uniquely suited to this topic. The answer I keep coming back to in my stories is that we can't know, and this is maybe the heart of why I write fantasy. My mentor, James Gunn, has occasionally gone out on a limb and said that science is observation plus statistical probability plus faith. Faith that if you see a ball drop 100 times, all other things being equal, it will also drop the 101st time. But it might not, and if it doesn't, who are we in a world where something apparently impossible could happen? It is possible that nothing is impossible. Science fiction says that faith can't move mountains, but we have seen it do so every time the ground is cleared with an earth mover to build a church. There are wonders in the world that open themselves to fantastic explanations, and I am willing to let that be possible. Many years ago, I was walking on the Oregon coast, and a stone caught my eye. It was a little brighter than its neighbors, a mottled rust and dark teal. It was rounded and just about the size to fit my hand. So I reached down and I picked it up. It was hard and grainy to the touch and rimed with salt. And when I turned it over in my hand, it broke in half and dissolved into sand that poured through my fingers. Since then, I have asked myself how this happened and why, and I've come up with more than one plausible explanation, but the fact is, I have no idea. There are explanations that bridge the gap between here, a world where it can take millennia for a rock to turn to sand, and there, a world where a woman can do it by just touching it. The world is full of strange things, full of things that make no sense. Maybe that is one of them. Why should my fiction not acknowledge that world? All fiction is an attempt to make sense of a world that doesn't care whether it makes sense or not. What is the difference between accepting that a bathtub full of monkeys may exist somewhere in this strange world and accepting that for no reason at all, you may lose someone you love? Neither should exist, neither makes sense, and yet the one is real and the other is not. In recent years, I've strayed quite far onto the wilder shores of metafiction. My work of late has usually been in the fantastic mode, but not really in the genre, and it uses very few formulaic elements. Although monkeys might be seen as being a universally fantasy element. With my latest work, I've been rediscovering stories that are just basically stories with conventional characterization and straightforward narrative structures. What I like to call interesting people doing exciting things in clothes I don't have at home. My current project is essentially realistic, but it is historical fiction, which does have a lot in common with certain sorts of fantasy. And because I cannot seem to write without engaging directly with strangeness, it also has the fantastical mode's break with reality and the more real-life difficulty of bridging the gap between individuals and peoples. Kylan the Movable City is set in 1778 in our world, with one exception, the existence of Kylan, which is a small vertical city that has for more than 1,000 years moved instantly and unpredictably from one location to another. It has been settled for nearly a decade in Hyde Park when Fanny St. George accompanies her husband into Kylan and relocates unexpectedly to Tashkent in what is now Uzbekistan, but was at that point a backwater of the Ottoman Empire on the Moribund Silk Road. 70 English men and women find themselves transported with it. The story is also about capitalist anarchy and Kowloon Walled City and Central Asia's geopolitics and Orientalism, urban warfare, 19th century natural history, the electrical theories of Joseph Priestley, and the diaries of Fanny Burney. That's the short list. It's also about what it means to be a woman who is not a mother and what it is that invests her in the future. And it is also about the way I felt the very first time I read Hilary Mantel and Patrick O'Brien. It is also about the ways that people cope with the impossible and how people bridge the gap between the self and the other. But that last, at least, is what all my writing is about. No story is simple. It always combines the real, the mythic, and the self, and we each do it in each story in a different way. So I'm going to close by reading this short scene, which takes place very close to the beginning, as the city moves unexpectedly from London to Tashkent. This is in draft, and it changes every time I read it, and is marked up like crazy. It is just past 1 p.m, which Fanny knows, for she has just heard a watch bell ring. She sits on a narrow bench with her friend Mai in Kylan's well yard, drinking hot sugared wine, but she is on her way out to call upon her father in Little Queen Street, with a folder of correspondence she has written out fair for him, and to give her stepbrother his birthday gift, a clockwork mouse that eats and defecates wooden pellets. Her footman Thomas is with her to carry her packages. He waits at one of the hatches set into the well yard's walls, drinking ale and exchanging news with the seller. Fanny and Mai drinking hot sugared wine. They make an odd but pretty pairing. Fanny attired to walk in London, full skirts and panniers in dark rose, and her hair dressed high under a cap and tricorn. Mai a little woman, with the honeyed complexion common to Kylenians, and her black hair unpowdered, short and worn close to her head, in a green gown that just reveals her ankles and blue felt slippers. The yard is not busy. Only a dozen people are reading the sojic boards, papered over as always with messages, but there has been no great news lately, so it is all old or frivolous, mere gossip merely. At a table nearby, a woman with a tiny spotted dog feeds it bits of sausage from a vendor. It is a cold day, and the wind outside blows down the slender shaft of the well yard, 15 stories down and 20 yards across, very like a well itself, and sets to moving all the things that hang from the buildings that ring it, signs, banners, ropes, clothing hung from drying lines. The shutters and windows on every wall are open, and planks and catwalks laid across the corners, shortcuts from building to building. The sun at its highest never reaches to the yard's silver floor and the well at its center, but one may judge what time it is by the angle and depth of the light, a scaffold sundial of sorts. In October, it does not come far, a bright golden slant against the top stories of the Clusey building on the yard's north face. Beyond all this is the London sky, a small square of brilliant blue and a few small fair weather puffs of cloud, cumulus. Pigeons fly down, pick through the scattered straw and refuse. Fanny hears voices from the windows and laughter. Music comes from far overhead, a lute maker testing a new instrument, many notes in quick succession. A man sings a quick pattering tune in a rough voice. The Kylenians speak many languages and seem to mix them to their own taste. Fanny recognizes few of the phrases, and then of a sudden in English, the Pentana gargoyle leaves its place and seeks a better name and face, and then back into garble. Pantana is the name of a stairwell here in the Grasshopper building, and they have a monster of some sort, like a lion, carved of basalt and very ugly, perched upon their roof and glaring down into an alley. Beyond that, she has no idea of the meaning. Five or six stories overhead, a clear voice, "Get along now." Fanny looks up and sees the speaker leaning from a window and one of Kylan's snakes pouring off a catwalk and onto a balcony. Fanny thinks the snake is Chena, but after 6 months here, she cannot name them. They are so many, and all equally black and glossy. She can tell them only apart by their size and hunting scars. This one is 6 feet in length, perhaps a fine large size. Fanny stands to take her leave. The little spotted dog drops its sausage and barks suddenly, stiff-legged, fur bristling, and then other dogs join in from everywhere, until every dog in Kylan barks or howls. There is a low noise beneath, a grumble in her bones. Thunder? She glances up toward the sky, the clear sky. Everyone else seems to understand something she does not, for they stumble to the center of the well yard, away from the walls. Namai shouts something that Fanny cannot hear. Tom across the well yard does not wait, but drops his mug, beer arcing out as it falls and runs towards them. The low voice grows suddenly, much louder, louder even than the dog's. There is a groan and the crack of a tree struck by lightning, but going on for a great time. Fanny is tossed and then hurled with great force to the ground. A wind bursts from the doors and windows of the well yard and whirls up in a great rising spiral, defined by dirt and all the things ripped from the sojic board and the walls, and the pigeons hurled up unwilling, wings and tails asplay, outlined against the red sky. Fanny has some notion that one of the buildings encircling the yard must be collapsing. A catwalk in one corner breaks free and crashes down. A barrel falls from a window many stories up and bursts with a great explosion of water and splinters. Fanny hears the sound of shattering pottery somewhere above and glances up from between her hands. The sky, it changes. And for a moment, she cannot take this in, sees it as a trick or even a failing of her eyes. The blue, the sunlight reaching down the face of the Clusey building, the cumulus, are gone. It has altered in an instant to thin shreds of red-tinted cirrus and a dimming sky, no direct light at all, the well yard suddenly gloomy. It is somehow incredibly near sunset. The city has moved. Afterward, Fanny tries to make sense of it. She understands the altered time of day immediately. They have shifted their meridian. They have moved east. But the abruptness of the change, was there an intermediate stage between London's sky and this new one when the shreds pushed aside the puffs, a flash or an instant of darkness? She was looking up and it changed, but there was no transition that she discerned. She has no vocabulary for a change so abrupt. Even an eye blink takes longer. Though she knows she is a careful observer, Fanny saw nothing, but the sky was much obscured by the flying rubbish. It is easier for her to believe it is her own failing. The spiraling wind reverses itself and slams its gleanings back down the well yard, even the pigeons, and this new and colder wind tears still more free from the walls and throws everything onto the base, the tables, the benches, the men and women. Crashing noises, cries, shouts, glass breaking, the continued barking of the dogs, and then a vast grinding crash somewhere inside Kylan. As she has always speculated, an earthquake or a shipwreck must sound that goes on for some moments. The buildings tremble, and dust puffs outward from the seams between the pink stones of the Clusey building. Fanny pushes aside the things that have fallen on her, providence that there is nothing heavier than a basket that contains some quills and a roll of scarlet paper spooling out, and she struggles to her feet, but falls back to the floor with darkness before her eyes, so short of breath that she fears she will faint away. She stands again, more cautiously. There is crying, shouts. Everywhere, papers, mugs, splintered wood. Her skirts are soaked through with water. The awnings that sheltered the vendors are torn or gone, the hatches mere gaping holes, every bench and seat overturned and buried in detritus. The little dog that started the barking shakes itself out from beneath the tipped table and stands as though confused by what it has wrought, sees its mistress and runs to her. She kneels in the welter beside a man who lies unconscious, weeping and shaking but useless. Fanny sees with a sudden sickness that the man's arm is crushed. Fanny feels herself distanced from all emotion. She steps toward them, but a man, one of the wine sellers, Naharan, comes to them first and seems competent enough, and she sees she can do little more than he and would be much in the way. Mai is still on the ground. Fanny reaches down to help her to her feet. She takes her arm and tries to rise and then shakes her head, says something in a language Fanny does not know, and then, "Do not let it be broken." Her ordinarily golden skin is sheet white. The man with the crushed arm is thrashing with the pain, held down forcibly now by two others. A few feet from them, there is a woman who has fallen from one of the windows. She bleeds from her mouth. Two are crushed there with, or are crouched there with her, a third staggering away, calling for a physician. There is a pigeon on the ground, only a foot or two away, stunned and fluttering weakly. It will be stepped upon, she thinks, and pushes it under a bench, a handful of hot feathers. When I first began writing, my goal was to get inside people and change them. I wanted to write about cold so convincingly that they would shiver. I wanted to make them imagine what it would feel like to have a tail. I wanted them to open doors differently because of something I had said. I wanted them to break their hearts all for me. Writing was and is an invasive and a manipulative act, and I saw it as such. I will make you see this. I will make you feel this. All fiction is manipulative, that's true, but this means something different to me now than it did then. It's not that I want to make you feel something so much as I want to feel that we are feeling the same thing, that I have moved away from the poles of the spectrum, my unmediated experience and my uncontrolled dream stuff, and toward a place where we can communicate. And because I see this world as a place that is full of strangeness, I hope that this is a place where we both can share that strangeness. I think this is something that fantasy does better than any other literature, and I'm happy to be able to produce fantasy that does what I want, at least some of the time. So thank you very much for listening, and I'm happy to take questions.
Say thank you to kids for such an interesting lecture, and maybe we can start by taking a few questions. Yes.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk on fantasy and also for sharing your literature with us.
Thank you.
And as you were reading, I was very much struck by the sense of isolation or alienation, and then you came out and said, you know, this idea of the self and the other. And it also strikes me that this is true of quite a lot of recent fantasy fiction and speculative fiction. Mm-hmm. And then thinking back to Tolkien, you know, we're all here And there's an element of that in the fellowship, certainly, with Frodo. But then again, we also have this strong sense of fellowship. And that what's sometimes called a homosocial seed that really produces fantastic co-work. And so I know this isn't directly related to the content of your talk, but I was wondering if maybe you could comment on that shift.
Well, that's an interesting thing because it resonates somewhat with what Paul Kincaid, who's a critic, has said recently about how science fiction may be essentially either asleep or moribund, that it tends to look back. And so I think that as a genre, perhaps, he may be right. I'm not going to say that, everybody. But there is something to be said for the fact that science fiction often does look backwards towards previous science fiction, and it may be a flaw that the genre must fight against. If that is true, I think it is also possible that fantasy is looking more and more towards isolation and maybe towards anomie, and that it is, again, a weakness that we as a genre should struggle against. I know the book I'm working on, it's like I'm very conscious of the fact that my writing had become more and more solipsistic and less penetrable. And so this is actually me saying, I want to write about a bunch of people, you know, exciting people who get together and do stuff. So I do think that there is some of that in recent fantasy, and I think, especially if you read like Kelly Link, you know, authors like that, where there's so much isolation in what's being said. Perhaps we reflect the times, but I think also it is something that comes into fantasy, the sense, the unbridgeable gap between my fantasy world, my mythic vision, and somebody else's.
Thank you very much for your lecture. I also really like Catherine Hume's Continuum. I was wondering whether in class your students plotted your own stories on that continuum. If so, when?
Well, the stories, it was interesting because we didn't do that until sort of the last week, and they said, we're going to read one of your stories. And I said, no, you're not. And they said, yes, we are. In fact, we have. And so that last week, there was one day where they had read four or five of my short stories, and they were like arguing about where to put them. And the big challenge they found was the fact that I use very immediate details, very, very, very immediate details in very mythic settings. And they had a real difficulty with that because they were like, well, you know, you're talking about Subarus and dying dogs and, you know, urine running down your leg and stuff like that. But we're also in this place, this impossible magical place. So where does it fit exactly? And what they ended up doing is sort of putting things all over. And then they had a few stories that they just said, because by this time we were envisioning mimesis, fantasy, or mythos, and then metafiction, this big sort of blurry thing that would pull you off the line from those, although metafiction tended to pull you towards mythos. So they would plot things like down here and say, we think it's fantasy, but we don't know. So story kit was actually the biggest challenge for them, was trying to figure out where that fit.
Right, were there any great surprises that your students came up with? Did they do something you didn't expect in terms of where they placed your fiction?
Well, I was somewhat surprised by, because I read Spar, which is this very graphic story that I wrote about. It's hard to explain, but it's about the failure of communication between an alien and a human in a very, very tight lifeboat. And they all saw it as very realistic, and yet not a single thing in it could exist except for one tiny scene. So they were like, that's very realistic. And I said, why is that? And it was the language. It was because I was using very earthy language they were looking at language and using language as their determinant of realism. So Anglo-Saxon words all of a sudden made it look like realism, whereas if I'd used elevated words, it would have looked like fantasy.
This question from the stairs.
Thanks. So a comment and a question. The comment was, I was really struck in the bestiary short pieces about the use of the second person. So I always felt second person is really scary, and it's hard to extend for a long period. So I feel that it was quite natural in a small space.
Right.
And I've struggled. That's a really difficult line to walk. But my question is actually about the this mimetic spectrum that you identify, that you're working with this other idea. So I think at the beginning you define the mimetic mode as rooted in the author's experience. So I'm assuming it means sort of the here and now.
Mm-hmm.
and the real world. But it seemed to me that there was at least two axes that led to the fantastical dream logic. And so the two axes I see are sort of the extension from here and now, either into the future or the past. Mm-hmm. So sci-fi is sort of like, you can look at, Philip K. Dick is saying, well, here's one aspect of our current culture. If that was just emphasized a little bit, this would be a very natural progression.
Yeah.
And it's exactly just the real world projected a little bit into the future along a certain certain train of thought. Whereas what you were doing was the other axis, which is taking the right now and throwing in something fantastical right into the absolute current reality the author is familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there's at least these two ways you can approach
it. Yeah, there are two movements. I can see what you're saying. Science fiction can be considered, and of course I hesitate to talk about theory because there are noted theorists in this room, but to my mind, science fiction, and I've heard other people say as well, science fiction and realism are very much actually in the same field, because in both cases they're saying this could happen. Maybe it hasn't yet, but it could happen. Whereas, and fantasy by its nature says this can't happen. And for me personally, in spite of things like that stone, I don't really believe that anywhere in this world there is a bathtub that monkeys vanish out of, but it could nevertheless happen. So I see what you're saying, and I think the movement, whether you are inserting, moving into, bringing something unnatural
right.
into the here and now, or moving something unnatural as a result of thinking about the here and now, moving it out, that's an interesting distinction. I like that.
I have one from the balcony.
Yeah. Are you reading any fantasy right now that you're particularly enjoying?
Yes, but actually I'm teaching. I set up this class thinking it was an advanced class, this spring class I'm teaching. So I picked all these really ambitious readings and then found out it was a bonehead English class for freshmen. So they're reading Margaret Cavendish's The Blazing World. And that's actually one of the more accessible ones. But right now I'm reading Calvino's If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler again. And just fascinated because, of course, it's not really fantasy, but it's so supremely metafictional. I also am going back to the classics because there's all kinds of stuff that I hadn't read for a while. And so I'm reading Dracula at the moment. And, it's really easy to read it when you're 12 or 14 or whatever age you read it at, and then just never go back to it and just say, kid stuff. And people do that with Tolkien too, actually. But when you go back as an adult, as a reasoning adult, and as a adult with critical faculties, you'll find amazing things in it. So I'm really enjoying doing that right now, but mostly Calvino.
One thing which I think is especially common in fantasy that's not that, but it does crop up in other sorts of more realistic literature too, is the punch the air moment. The moment in the narrative, and it may just be an action or it may be words, where people go, yes! The obvious example in Tolkien is when Eowyn reveals herself.
Yes.
There's the bit in The Princess Bride where Ignatz has been stabbed and pulls his broken body together and says, I am Ignatz Montoya, you killed my father, prepared to die, and just repeats that over and over again and drives the person who thinks he's killed him mad with, and gets more strength by doing so. I mean, there are other examples. There's the bit in Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell where the Duke of Wellington says, could a sorcerer kill a man by magic? And Jonathan Strange says, yes, but a gentleman never would. Which is kind of a verbal equivalent, but one last is in Great Expectations, where Miss Havisham says, so cold, and Estelle says, who taught me to be cold? Who praised me when I learned my lesson? So hard, who taught me to be hard? And Miss Havisham goes, ah, but Estelle, to be cold and hard to me. I think one of the joys of fantasy is it creates those moments more regularly than almost anything.
I think perhaps we're more pronounced. I do think that moment when you call it a punch the air moment, I think of it as the moment that the frisson happens. They go, that little moment of satisfaction, the shiver that says yes. As a writer, I never don't think about craft. This is why I don't actually read a lot of fiction. So when I nowadays, when I read that and I get to that moment, I'm like, yes, you got me. But I'm always thinking whether that's what the writer wanted. I'm like, yes, point to you, sir. But I think fantasy actually, because we're working in with a big brush sometimes, you know, we can go to mythic types, mythic moments, mythic elements and tropes. And so it's not just a random woman saying something wise to you, it's Athena saying something wise to you. So all of a sudden we raise the stakes and the frisson is stronger, I think.
And maybe two more questions and then we'll wrap up.
My question's related to that one, and I kept thinking of wish fulfillment as the question was being phrased, so I was wondering if you thought that there might be an enhanced relationship, so to speak, between fiction and wish fulfillment in fantasy that's sort of less common in other types of literature. I think that's an aspect of it as a genre that at least attracts me.
I think one of the problems with talking about fantasy is that we use this big term to refer to very narrow sections. So we say fantasy literature as though we can point to it and say. So I think there is a lot of fantasy, that is exactly what it is. I want to live in Middle Earth. I want to be able to walk through a wardrobe. I want to be able to kill vampires with my eyes. You know, I want to shoot laser beams out of my eyes. Why does that not happen in this world? So I want that very much. There is a lot of it, but I know most of what I write is not wish fulfillment. It's not happy stuff. And there are a lot of writers like me who we perhaps, you know, I've also heard it said that fantasy is the literature of wishes and nightmares, dreams and nightmares. And I don't think that's true either for me, but I do think that for me, I think it's more a matter of here's another vocabulary. Here's a sideways way to see things. How do I get through this? How do I see differently? So it's not an escape, but on the other hand, boy, I go back and I reread, you know, Jane Austen and put on the little outfits in my mind quite a lot. So
I have a question about something you said about history writing and writing historical spaces and that linking historical spaces to fantasy. I'm really interested in this myself because I'm both a historian and a skeptic writer. So when you're talking about the idea of historical fiction as sharing a certain amount of DNA, the DNA of posterity, with speculative fiction, especially fantasy, if you could comment further on that, I was really interested in that idea.
I also was a historian. I was not an English major, and I didn't start writing until I was 25. So to me, I came to this as a history person, and to my mind, this is why my problem with most epic fantasy is that you're writing it in an essentially historic world, however far you're straying from our world, but you're writing essentially, you know, pre-technological or early technological, and you're picking, you know, a century, except you aren't. There's a very specificness to history, and to my mind, that specificity is what's important in fantasy as well. Just telling me they are writing, trying to think of a good example, just telling me that they are using swords, less interesting than what is the difference between a 7th century sword, you know, in Whitby and a 12th century sword in Japan and an 18th century sword in Persia? You know, it is, why can you not make it that particular and specific? And so to me, the DNA they share is the fact that we are trying to recreate a world that we cannot actually see, that we are producing evidence for as we go. History, the evidence is out there, and we just collect it. We just pull it together, interpret and interpolate. And fantasy, we are drawing from history. We're drawing from whatever our sources are. But then we are also generating new material. So we are our own artifact troves, even as we are our own, you know, even as we write this. So at its best, I think, especially heroic and epic fantasy, is being written by people who are historians of a place that doesn't exist.
Great. Well, thank you, Kij, again, for such a fascinating
Thank you so
lecture.
Much. Thank you.
is a small token of Pembroke community's appreciation for pushing our imaginations tonight. So thank you for
so much.
Coming all this way to come speak to us tonight
and for
inaugurating the first Tolkien lecture.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, everyone's invited to join us in the Pembroke MCR for a drinks reception where kids will be available to ask more questions, to share thoughts and feelings about science fiction fantasy literature. It is just outside on staircase 3 on the second floor, and everyone is please do come and continue this wonderful evening. So, and thank you all for coming out tonight.
Thanks. Come back next year.